And then the theory is that it was some military planes really that did it, and they hijacked the actual planes and put them someplace else and blew them all up, and that all the phone calls were not right, that were not true. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that video? Is that ringing any bells?
That video doesn't sound familiar to me.
No. Yeah. But it sounds like a new one. And there is some credible sources who do say that the cell phones were impossible to occur from those planes, that they were all faked. And there is an excellent video by Eric Hufschmidt, a companion to his book Painful Questions, which looks at what happened to the World Trade Center and to the Pentagon. And he has very compelling visual evidence that there were explosives in the World Trade Center. And from the seismic data and the thermal data.
Yes. I think that's the one we're thinking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you've seen that one.
Yeah. Eric Hufschmidt.
Yeah.
And that the Pentagon was hit by a drone or a missile rather than...
Yes, that's the one. That's the one, yeah.
But I think Eric, I talk to him all the time. In fact, I sell the video and the book when I'm tabling at events.
Yes.
And I think he's a genuine sort of nerd geek software engineer who came up with a lot of information on his own and tried to put it together. But I don't think it's CIA disinformation, because one of the main theses, well, he looks at, in his book, at the John F. Kennedy assassination and the parallels to the cover-up that's happening around the evidence about the World Trade Center.
Yes.
And I think one of the important pieces that he overlooks or doesn't emphasize enough is that the real fingerprints of special operations, of CIA special operations, is what doesn't happen. And detailing how there had to be stand-down orders at the highest level of government. Mm. And I don't think he covers that very well. We just came back from Sacramento, and we table about 7 or 8 different videos, and each researcher looks at different aspects, and there's no perfect, comprehensive
story. Well, actually, you know, that film and that book by Eric Hufschmidt, they both focus on physics and thermodynamics and science, and they don't focus on politics and economics at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it is scientific fact that you know the smoke in the World Trade Center had turned black, which means it oxidized, which means the fires had cooled right before the collapses. That the tower that collapsed a half hour earlier than was the tower that was hit second and was hit indirectly, and the jet fuel burned up outside. The jet fuel doesn't burn hot enough to deform steel. That the towers collapsed at barely slower than the rate of free fall, and there were tapes that were national security was claimed on of firefighters and firefighting engineers. These are the top firefighters in New York in the impact zones of the towers before they collapsed, communicating with the Port Authority of New York. National security was claimed on the tapes, and then because of protests that the firefighters' family members be able to hear these tapes, the family members were able to hear them, and what was on the tapes was that was the firefighters saying the fires are mostly out, we can get people down from above the impact zones.
It's containable.
And that bombs were going off, and you hear the explosions on the tapes. This is according to the survivors of the firefighters that died in the impacts at the time of collapse. And that was actually one of the most suspicious things on the day to me, was how they collapsed so suddenly and pulverized into dust.
Also,
as they collapsed.
Also, we have some footage. George Trinkus wrote a pamphlet, NBC Spins 9/11, and he basically recorded everything that came out on NBC that day. And the chief of fire safety for the New York Fire Department said that there were explosives in the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And it was said once, and it was never repeated ever again on NBC. And in his analysis of the media coverage, he says, well, there's one thing about spinning the news, but 9/11 was woven out of whole cloth.
Mm.
When you examine the story closely, you realize that there's no real evidence supporting the conspiracy theory that's spun by the media, by the government. Mm. Even now, I mean, the whole story has massive holes in it when you examine it. Just, you know, there's so many details, aspects, like the fact that The hijackers of the 19 identified by the FBI, 7 were still alive. One of them had been dead for a year or two. Mm-hmm. Very hard to do this when you've been dead for a year or two. And there's absolutely no evidence. The most damning evidence we have of government's conspiracy is from the government itself. Mm. When the FBI chief said there's no evidence that any of the hijackers planned this or tried to execute this in any formal fashion via internet communications, that there's no paper trail, we have absolutely no written evidence. And then also the most damning testimony in my mind is General Myers in his Senate confirmation hearings, when he said no planes were scrambled until after the Pentagon was hit, and that's a violation of the most standard operating procedures. I mean,
like my dad was in the Air Force. They always had jets on in the air.
Yeah. And they always scramble in the event of emergency. And even on the day of September 11th, routine planes were called so that they couldn't interfere with the attacks. So this is the most, you know, damning evidence, I would say, of the complicity at the highest levels of government for allowing it to happen. And if you do look at Eric Hufschmidt's book and the videotape, he also does speculate that World Trade Center building number 7, it couldn't have collapsed because of fire. It wasn't hit by a plane. It wasn't hit by debris. And he thinks that might have been the center of operations to bring the planes in if they had been controlled by a homing device or remotely controlled. That could have been the center of operations. They could have wanted to just simply destroy that evidence. Now, that is more speculative, but we don't have any evidence that those alleged hijackers were actually even on the planes. We don't know the details about what happened. We just know that the government is lying and that it couldn't have happened if they hadn't stood down the defenses that day.
Yeah, the video footage of Atta at the airport was Atta buying tickets to board the plane that took him to Boston, where the plane that was flown into the first of the World Trade Center towers was hijacked out of. So there actually is no footage of these guys. So it's surfaced. If it exists, we haven't seen it. But Atta's the most suspicious of all of the so-called hijackers because we know the most about him, and because his girlfriend's been interviewed by Daniel Hopsicker, who used to produce for NBC, and his landlord has been interviewed. His landlord's got rental receipts to prove that he was living with his American girlfriend, who was a stripper and an escort, and very un-Islamic, for at least 3 months before the FBI said he was in the U.S. And she said, when Hopsicker asked her about Atta, the first word out of her mouth was cocaine. And, you know, these guys, most of them don't appear to be Islamic fundamentalists. They don't even appear to be Islamic or religious in any sense, and act more like gangsters that were getting money from probably various sources, possibly government agencies.
Like JFK. K I L L I killing.
Yeah, there's, if you understand the John F. Kennedy assassination, it helps to understand what happened in 9/11. With Oswald, he was the patsy. He was painted as the patsy. And they created the personas of Muhammad Atta. And I have a copy of a video, and if you don't have it, I'll bring it after the show. But it's Muhammad Atta and the Flying Circus. It's Daniel Hopsicker's work, and he investigated the whole story of how these guys were trained. And it's just very, very suspicious. I think they were supposed to be the patsies, and they didn't expect journalists to actually dig into who these guys really were, but to, you know, go along with the big lie. Just like with Oswald. Oswald is infinitely more complex than the character they presented him to be to the public. The great thing now is that with the internet, there's an extraordinary cooperation amongst researchers, so we're able to pass this information along to one another and try to piece together the puzzle. And there's, you know, on our deception dollars, we have the Center for Cooperative Research, which has the amazing timeline put together by Paul Thompson, which takes from just basic mainstream sources all the little itty-bitty pieces. When you put them together, it's extremely compelling that, well, here the government said this thing this day, a different thing this day, and another thing this day, and look at all these different actions, and you could see the pattern of the lies and the cover-up. Also, in January 2002, when I became suspicious about 9/11, and we thought, well, what can we do about it? We organized a march on our senators and our congresswoman demanding an investigation of 9/11. And we raised big questions about what were the links between top U.S. government officials and the man who gave $100,000 to Muhammad Atta, who the FBI said was the lead hijacker. Were there plans for war in Central Asia prior to 9/11? You know, what were the interests of the Bush and Cheney in the oil and in the drugs in that region? You know, a whole lot of questions. And immediately after we did that, Bush and Cheney asked Daschle to limit the investigations, to limit the parameters, so that the investigation wouldn't be comprehensive. It would be, why did the CIA fail to prevent the attacks? How could the CIA prevent future attacks? And how could the CIA justify its budget, an increase in its budget? And because Congress was so busy fighting the war on terrorism, the whole investigation was to be overseen by the CIA. And the heads of the House and the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee, they were the very men who on September 11th were having breakfast with the head of Pakistani intelligence, who was the one who sent 100,000 to Muhammad Atta, and who was the one who funneled 4 billion from Saudi Arabia, 4 billion from the CIA to create the Al-Qaeda network. And he also was the one that Bush sent to Afghanistan to say, hand over bin Laden, when Bush didn't want bin Laden, but he wanted a war, and he wanted an excuse to deploy military troops in that region of the world and to take control of the pipeline route. So it all was just an obvious, huge cover-up. And then when they were forced to have the independent commission, who should they appoint but Henry Kissinger? Kissinger, who was hired by UNICAL to get the oil from Turkmenistan, who in the wake of September 11th was hired by a Chinese oil company to represent their interests. Kissinger, who's known to lie to Congress, who's wanted for mass murder in his role in all these atrocities worldwide, who Bush says reflects his interests. So there's another little red flag that there's a massive cover-up going on. And then when Kissinger didn't want to reveal his sources, then they replace him with who else? Thomas Kean, who people don't realize also has financial ties to bin Laden. He has oil interests, and he has two businesses in the World Trade Center. He could have planted the explosives himself. And this is the person who's supposed to investigate 9/11. And then you look at the parameters of the independent commission, and it's very narrow. They don't want the truth. They're not supposed to look for the truth. And if you overhear them in the hallways, like my friend did, who's part of the 9/11 Citizens Watch, you hear these guys talking about how they want to do the best cover-up in history. Mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor wasn't good enough. People found out about that. Mm-hmm. The Warren Commission wasn't good enough. People found out about that. So they want to do a great cover-up on 9/11 so people don't realize what happened.
They are failing at doing their great cover-up.
I think so. And I think we see it now with trying to contain the damage and maybe take Bush out of power because he's doing such a lousy job of containing the damage. Get him for the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq instead of blowing the lid on 9/11, which would take out the Republicans as well as the Democrats who are up to here in complicity from, you know, the time of Jimmy Carter allowing Zbigniew Brzezinski to instigate the policy in Afghanistan, which led to the creation of Al-Qaeda and, you know, has been followed through to the current day.
In, on, S, E, P, September 11th,
yeah.
1/10, on September 10th, that they were in D, E, deep T.
Trouble.
Yes.
Yes.
Then there was the G, L, O, B,
Global,
M,
Mobilization.
There were the C, O, R, P, Corporate, S, scandals.
Yeah.
E, etc. They were on the W, A, on the way. They were on the way out.
Yeah. I think this was 9/11 was a desperate attempt by the global elite to maintain power using fear, war, terrorism, their old traditional methods to retain control. And
A, L, I, T, a little, O, N, O, B, a little obvious. But they think if they can get A away with it in O, other, C, O, U, countries.
Right.
Yeah. They've been practicing on third world nations for 30, 40 years, and so they're using the same techniques on us now to see if they could get away with it. And we can't let them get away with it. We just can't. It's whether we can organize resistance faster than they can organize repression. But if you look at, you know, the historical parallels, what we see now is the rise of the Fourth Reich. Bush should be nailed for plagiarism. He's following Hitler's path. This is the American Reichstag. The Patriot Act mirrors the Enabling Act, which allowed Hitler to dismantle democracy in Germany.
At least H. Hitler
was elected.
Was A. A. R. T. an artist?
No. Well, he wasn't caught quite as easily.
George is just a M A S S mass
murderer
and A B A D bad L I
liar. Yeah. Yeah, somebody was saying that we should, on the deception dollar, we should have his tell, because he has what the gamblers call, when he's lying, he puts his finger next to his mouth, or there's some clue. So if you really observe him, you could tell when he's lying. He's not a good liar, and he's been caught lying so often, too, that they've created new euphemisms for the word in the press.
I think Cheney's probably the best liar of the bunch. Rumsfeld's a horrible liar, too. He's completely transparent, you know.
P-O, power, no, P-O-W-E, pow.
Oh.
Is not a good liar, is that what you're saying? Is not a good liar. Okay.
Yeah.
At the U N.
Yeah, and he was cut too. Yeah, I think we're going to win if anyone's paying attention.
But we need some one, two, V, O, vote for.
Oh, that's a trick, too, especially with rigged voting machines, even if we had someone to vote for.
I don't S. I don't see anyone to vote for.
Yeah, that's a problem.
I J. I just H. I just heard that P E A peace and freedom. Oh, may run Mumia?
Mumia. Yeah. Oh, that would be cool. Yeah, good idea. That's a great idea. Isn't that brilliant? Yeah. And if we could impeach Bush before the next election, then he'd have a chance, I'd say. That's great. Yeah, the only term Bush should be serving is in jail, and Mumia should be free. That's definitely. That would be justice.
Do. But I don't see anyone else to vote for.
Yeah, it's...
What do you think of Denis Kucinich?
In bed?
F. A fake
Kucinich. Well, I spoke to him a couple weeks ago, and he was trying to say the right things. And when I brought up the 9/11 issue, he said, "I'm not ready to discuss it now, but we have to get to the truth of it."
Exactly.
Yeah.
If he is not ready to discuss 9/11 and now he will not
ever
he'll never discuss it.
But I think maybe he would discuss it if we made enough noise and we created enough space. I think the politicians will change if there's enough outrage in the population.
No. Because I think D, E, M, Democrats. R, S, O, so, O, I, N, involved.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Democrats are, definitely.
Yes.
George Tenet made the transition, no problem. It was under Carter this started. The Democrats are...
That was Y, G, O, R, Gore, did not...
He didn't want to take the blame.
Or why he didn't fight for the election
in Florida.
Right.
Yeah.
Why he could see the writing.
The total recount.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you also, I think they wanted us to know it was rigged this time. Just
yes.
Part of
yeah.
the scare.
Yes. 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 Yeah.
The meta message.
Yes. We, P, L, played. Well, this was the thing. We played a tape one time. This was like a year or so ago. This guy, he was investigating. This was before the election, the last, the Bush-Gore election. In the 90s, he was investigating voter fraud. And he actually had footage of
in Florida,
right. And he had footage where he went into a building. It was all these, like, elderly, the women's group or something. And it was on videotape of them throwing the votes. You know, it was just like...
They were just discarding them.
And he was able to get in there and show all that. And then he... and they have footage of him on talk shows, like, revealing all this stuff. He... was after the S-A, the A-T, he was after the R-E-N-O, the Reno, he was after Reno. That's what he was going for, Reno.
Yeah.
And they have footage of him on talk shows where they're interviewing about this. He's given all the information. We had all that in the tape. And then he buys the major newspaper in Florida, and his whole thing was this was going to be the opening story. He was going to, like, lay all this information out, and, like, he dies. Right before so the paper never happens.
Oh,
he just all of a sudden he dies. He's like healthy one day, and the next day he's dead.
Well, Greg Palast has been bravely talking about the fraud of the Florida election, and there's some other people who've been talking about the rigged voting machines, and hopefully the American people will wake up to what's happening. But I do say that it is a huge problem, because if it's blatantly obvious that we can't even vote, then...
They are T E. They're telling us.
Yeah.
Don't even T R try.
Don't even try. There's no recourse. Yeah. We've been fighting the Patriot Act in Palo Alto, and I met with the chief of police recently and said, well, you know, if the president is committing treason and he's a criminal, what can I, a peaceful, caring citizen, do? And she basically said, do exactly what you're doing. Because we can't get the local police to arrest the president of the United States. All you can do is make noise and try to wake up the public and get the public to put the pressure on politicians to do the right thing. But if you can't even... choose your own politicians, it makes you feel like, oh, well, we can't do anything. So I'm afraid they're reducing our choices and expecting the general IMF riots of the third world, where the only way that the American people are going to have recourse is to through civil disobedience, through massive actions in order to put the pressure on Washington, D.C., and that's why they're passing so many of these horrendous laws to actually identify the real target of these policies. It's not terrorists, it's the American public, because we're the only ones who have the power right now to stop the global elite from their path to global domination. And they're trying to clip our wings and make us that's utterly powerless true. And scared.
That they want us to be hopeless.
Yes, of course. And so that's what we can't be. And there's more of us than them.
I and there are all kinds of W ways to W I to win.
Yes, 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 there are. And I think, you know, just art, truth, courage, hope, faith, cooperation, there's all those things that we value and cherish. Those are the things that we have to nurture. The dominant paradigm is failing. They're losing their legitimacy. It's only maintained by the smoke and mirrors of the mainstream press. People are seeing through it. They're bypassing it.
They're scared. Yes.
They're scared.
I was just going to say.
Totally scared. We're in a much better position. Well, we could have fun changing the world, but they're scared of losing power.
Just information by itself is the most important part. There are so many other important things, but information is the most important thing, because the reason why a small group of people can have power over a large group of people is because those people don't feel they're being oppressed, they don't feel they're living under a tyranny, and they willingly submit to it. And so when they know what it is, they fail to submit.
I had a L A B labor a activist on the show from Vicente from Argentina, and he was when Frank asked him, you know, why is all this happening, why are the people standing up in South America and not in the U.S. and he said it's because it won't happen until the middle class doesn't have the belief that there's a possibility that they will become the upper class. And in the United States, the middle class still believes that it's possible. If you know, if they just kind of they could have more money, they could have more power. And as long as that's a possibility in their mind, they're not going to get out on the streets. But in South America, it was so obvious that that wasn't true, that people had nothing to lose. And that's what got everybody out.
Right. It's the greed and the fear, that carrot and the stick, to try to co-opt people into going along with the ruling agenda.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at this point, they're just so blatantly malevolent and threatening everyone. Like, we just came from Sacramento, and there were activists from all over the world looking at agribusiness, how they've been forcing the genetically modified foods. I mean, they're threatening people's health, the water, in the most blatant sort of ways. And now with 9/11, they're threatening us physically and then psychologically, trying to terrorize people into duct taping their houses. And I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous if we can identify that the threat is not some Islamic terrorists from another country who are poor and desperate, who only know violence but it's our government who's been terrorizing the rest of the world and is terrorizing us right now. And they're the ones who are the greatest threat to our health, safety, and well-being. I think we can motivate people to to do something.
And B, E, behind the G, O, government, it is the C, corporations.
Yeah, exactly. Identify who are those 250 people who are on the boards of all the transnational corporations, who are running the world on a war economy, which makes them the most money, gives them the most concentration of wealth, who don't give a damn about how many people they kill in the process. And it's the necrophiliacs versus the biophiliacs. Mm. We're the biophiliacs who love and respect life. The necrophiliacs, if they can't control it or own it, they're willing to kill it, and they just are incapable of love. They can't love themselves. They can't love people. And they should be contained.
I ask. K. E. Kevin Danaher.
Oh.
How? Why? The. Why do they? Why do they do what they do? B, E, because it they D R I. Oh, they drink the, yeah, he was saying they drink the same water that we drink, so why aren't they thinking they're poisoning themselves and their families? They breathe the same air, et cetera. They eat the same food, kind of.
I used to ask myself, you know, are they evil or are they stupid? Or are they more stupid than evil? But somebody said evil is applied stupidity, and this is what we're seeing on a global scale.
They are. L. I. Living in a U. N. Unreal?
Yeah.
Unrealistic?
Yes.
U, N, R, unreal, unreality. They are living in an unreality of D, E, denial.
And I think it was Aung San Suu Kyi who said, it is not power that corrupts, but fear. Fear of losing power and fear of the scourge who wield it. And what we see there is these guys are actually terrified, and they're trying to maintain their power and control, you know, through the most violent means. And but they're probably have created their own hell and their own illusion to get through the days. I wouldn't want to be in their place, actually.
Well, an interesting thing about, you know, these, about, well, both George W. Bush and Dick Cheney have very, two of the most energy efficient, ecologically sound homes that have ever been built. Okay, so while they're telling everyone not to conserve energy and that this is not important, they know very well that there's going to be less and less oil, less and less natural gas. And that and so while they're not preparing to move on to other energy sources, because, well, oil goes gold, then oil goes platinum, it's worth more, you have more power because you control it, you have more military power, you have more economic power because you're controlling a dwindling resource that's necessary for commercial agriculture, for plastics, for so many different things. So, you know, that at the same time, yeah, they're poisoning themselves, but they're also trying to protect themselves while they screw the rest of us over.
But they're so guilty of doing so many crimes against humanity and the planet for such a long time that they're afraid that of the wrath or the truth of what comes up. If people knew what they're responsible for, of the wrath, I would say, of the whole planet. That's why they're operating from this fear place and like, doing such destructive things.
Like I, J, I just, T, A, talked to, A, G, O, V, E, government, government, S, C, I,
scientist,
who, W, O, R, worked, A, works, in the G R E E.
Oh, whatchamacuzzi from Washington. Right. He works on the greenhouse effect. That's what his focus of work is, the greenhouse effect. He said the C O M common, no, C-O-M-P, U, computer. Oh, that the computer, what do you call that? The
simulation.
M, yeah, the simulation, M, mock-ups were actually, it's happening faster than it was predicted.
Right.
And the M, O, D, the model, models, S, A, said to, we, O, only have 50 years before the P, O, poison, POI, point of no return. And he said that it's actually a lot, that's a shorter period of time than 50 years. They're finding out now.
Yeah, I've been hearing the same things. Like if they don't, if things don't change rapidly, the Gulf Stream is going to change. There's going to have a new ice age in Europe, and Europe's going to be frosted, etc. And yet there's no action on the part of the government to reverse that. I went to a climate change conference in Berkeley, and the NASA scientists were saying, oh, it's wonderful that we had the Kyoto agreements. At least people are aware now of climate change. 10 years ago, they weren't even aware. Even if Kyoto is totally inadequate to address the problem, at least people are aware of the problem, and which I thought was terribly frightening because they're not thinking action. They're just thinking, oh, well, at least people know finally that they're not doing anything about it.
Not A, not to, not to mention the U S is T trying to
kill
the
Kyoto. Yeah, right. Another reason we should impeach Bush. Quickly. Very quickly to change. I've been going to the Bioneers conferences for the last 6 or 7 years, which focuses on all the solutions that are never mentioned also in the mainstream press. And it's amazing the restorative, recuperative powers of the Earth systems if you can work with them.
It would be easy.
Yeah,
if the will was there.
What we have to do is expose the truth about 9/11 and then shift all the resources out of killing the planet to restoring the planet and to meeting human needs. And there's also, have you should talk to, there's a guy, Dr. Roth, who put a big full-page ad in the New York Times. Did you see it? It looked at the World Trade Center and the Reichstag fire. But he also said this was a desperate attempt of the military, industrial, pharmaceutical, intelligence complex, because one of the attacks that is happening on humans right now is from the pharmaceutical medical industry, which is not telling them the natural way to cure themselves, how healthy food and water is really important, and is trying to sell them lots of drugs which are actually harmful. And if we can expose this cartel, which is undermining human health and thinking as well, I mean, there's a deliberate attacks to dumb people down and not let them be fully cognizant and healthy and functioning, then, you know, if we can expose that, if we could get people healthy and shift those resources. I mean, if we look at how much money is being poured into the military, the black budget, all these special operations, militarizing space.
I and W I with no E N E enemy.
Oh yeah,
all the money being put into the military with no enemy.
Yeah, well, they have enemies, but they're expensive enemies. They create them as part of the military budget.
We're the enemy.
Yes, yes. Right now it is. It's the global elite against the global majority, and it doesn't matter if you're in New York City or in Los Angeles or in Argentina or in Iraq or Afghanistan. You are a target in the eyes of the global elite if you're not. And even if you're working with them, you're expendable. I mean, look at how many people they sacrifice to further their agenda. How many people's health
P
and lives.
E R P R no P E Perry. He's the guy. Perry is the guy who works for the greenhouse effect for the government. Is H O P E hopeless.
Oh, hopeless? All right.
You mean he's feeling hopeless? He feels hopeless about it. B E because he is in the S system.
Yeah. He should get out of there, and then he would be more hopeful, because if he was out of the system, then he could be an activist and wake people up and get them to do things. That's how you get hopeful.
How did you get S started?
Oh, 11 years ago, I saw the film JFK, and I started doing research on the CIA. And when I found out what the CIA was doing, I became involved, and I started being an activist. And then I met other activists, and I learned more. And the more you do, then the more you know you can do. And one of the most important books that I usually table and information is a book called Doing Democracy by Bill Moyer. He used to be a strategist for Martin Luther King, and he did the Social Movement Empowerment Project for 40 years. And he maps out the stages of social movements and the roles activists could play at different parts in social movements and how social movements pull one another along. And he was just brilliant. He did great spiritual, personal transformation work, but he also did great movement building. And so his work is what I always have on my tables. And he also has a great chart, sort of a map of the paradigm where you see it. In order for 4% of the world's population to devour the vast majority of the resources, they basically have to impose brutal military regimes to steal those resources. They need the IMF, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization to help with that flow. And they need special operations like the Gulf of Tonkin, Pearl Harbor, the World Trade Center attack to get public support for their wars. But this is a system which is devastating to most of the world's ecosystems, everything, the future. And this is the paradigm that we need to change. And then he proceeds to write how we can do it and what activists can do. And there's actually, I'd say, more activism now than ever before. And I've been working on trying to change the monetary system, the whole global economy, for 7 years. And I've seen progress. I was in Denver when the G8 summit was there in 1996, and there were like 1,000 people out in the streets. In Genoa, there were hundreds of thousands. I tried to bring North Americans to the first World Social Forum in Brazil, where the whole theme was, another world is possible. We need an economy that serves life, not a tiny global elite. And we're part of a global majority. Mm. We don't realize how many people there are around the world who share our values and our hopes and our aspirations. And all the people in the United States don't realize how many of us there are. We still need to make the greater connections and weave the movement to a stronger force. What we were trying to do in Sacramento this weekend was to tie together the anti-corporate globalization movement and the anti-war movement and the healthy food movement with a deeper understanding of the current global political situation so that we could be a stronger movement.
It is one. It is all one.
Exactly, exactly. And people are beginning to realize, I mean, there's a pattern here. And when you see through the corporate lies, it's not just this issue or that issue. They all are connected under, you know, the umbrella of the global economics. And how, I've been trying to change the monetary system. And one of the things about money that most people don't realize is, next to brute military force, money is the most powerful tool of empire with the economy. And right now they're using, you know, every tool in their toolbook to suppress and to consolidate wealth and power. War and terror, as well as economic forcing, trying to siphon and shift their weight around with their economic power. But this is also, the system is rupturing. I mean, one of the reasons for the war in Iraq, it was over, are the oils going to be in euros? Are they going to be in dollars? There's schisms within the global elite itself. And there's a struggle over resources. There's more fracture. There's pressure on all these global groups more and more from below. So that it's harder for them to maintain their power. Their CIA tricks and operations are sloppy. They're not working. Their attempted coup in Venezuela failed. So there's all sorts of hopes for change.
A.S. I asked. P.D. Scott.
Oh, Peter.
Yes. Is the CIA D dumb or S smart? He said they H.I. hire dumb people. So they always have to see oh, cover up the fuck ups.
Yeah, Peter, we showed Aftermath, the latest documentary by Guerrilla News Network, in San Francisco and in Palo Alto, and Peter was there. And we're going to be showing it again in Berkeley on July 2nd. Peter Dale Scott will be there, and there is. There is some contention because Peter Dale Scott does say that one reason they're covering up is there are these very embarrassing links between the terrorist organization and top U.S. government officials. So even if the U.S. government officials aren't responsible for the things that the CIA assets do, they look really bad because of these connections.
Yes.
Whereas other people like Michelle Chasudovsky says, these guys are CIA assets. They're doing exactly what the CIA tells them, and these are special operations.
In reality, B, both are true. Both can be true.
Yeah. And if you look at 9/11 too, I think that it was a botched operation. And that's one reason that it's their Achilles heel, and they can be caught. Because there was that one plane that took 40 minutes extra to leave the runway. Now, if it had left on time, and those disasters had happened boom, boom, boom in the span of 7 minutes, they might have been believable. But because there was that jet lag delay.
But H-A-L, half hour.
Yeah, that's
can't be explained.
Yeah, there's no way they can go around that. They've tried lying. They've come up with every lie they could come up. They've contradicted themselves, and they can't.
You could. You could get that L A last. You could get that last plane. W I with A with a H helicopter.
Yeah. Although I do think that the one that went down in Pennsylvania was shot down. There's a lot of evidence. There's a guy who has a great website. I mean, the plane was all over the place, 8 miles. There's no way that there was an explosion in the air, and there were people who saw another plane.
If they can not get one plane, then Star Wars.
Oh yeah.
Will
disaster
not work?
Well, let's hope it doesn't work.
Because the main purpose of it is actually to create what's termed as full spectrum dominance, which Donald Rumsfeld and William Kristol and Richard Pearl refer to as full spectrum dominance, which is spy satellites and military satellites with lethal capabilities ringing the Earth so that you could actually be able to spy on or kill people from a satellite in orbit. And that's referred to in the document Rebuilding America's Defenses from the Project for the New American Century, and it's referred to in quite a number of other documents.
It's a very offensive weapon. It doesn't have anything to do with defenses.
My stepfather was a computer programmer for Lockheed Martin at White Sands Missile Range. I grew up outside of Alamogordo, New Mexico, and we did get to go out there and see this, and this would have been in... it was in the 80s sometime when we went out and saw it. It would have been the mid 80s, I guess. And there were, they showed us a film of using this laser. It was a massive building to produce the laser. And it was cutting the nose off a drone F-16 and watching it crash into a mountain. I mean, this is what they were doing. It was really obvious that it was not primarily for defensive capabilities at that point, and it's certainly not today.
Why did you get fired?
I was giving away free copies of a documentary film by Alex Jones. A Texas radio show host. He's much more like from the right-wing kind of element. He actually predicted September 11th on his public access show in Texas and told people to call the White House and tell them that we blame them if it happens, because he was following news reports so closely. He was a big activist on exposing the cover-up of Oklahoma City, the World Trade Center bombing in 93. He's a big police state issue guy, right? So I was giving away free copies because he tells people to make free copies and give them away. And I was also giving away the deception dollars with all the websites. And I was giving it to my friends at work on breaks. It was all perfectly within the corporate guidelines of the, I worked for Neiman Marcus. I worked for this department store for 4 years, right? And they told me not to hand them out, and I argued that if they could bring the San Francisco Chronicle in and give that away, why can't I give this away? And I ended up being told to go home on suspension, and when I tried to take my videotape with me, I was tackled by security guards. They threatened to knock me out. They handcuffed me, and they held me for 45 minutes. So I'm suing for wrongful termination, assault, false arrest, and false detention. And my attorney is Stanley G. Hilton, who is the attorney who's suing the Bush administration on behalf of 400 September 11th victims' families for actually engineering the attacks.
We have not heard anything about that that suit, the one about the 400 families.
Right. Yeah, it's gotten very little publicity. The only major publicity that it's gotten was there was one article, very short article, in the San Francisco Examiner in early 2002, and that was the original lawsuit which he pulled. It was filed in Oakland, and he pulled the suit because he got so much more evidence, and that was more like the Bush knew suit. And his new one is like the whole cabinet was in on it suit, and they engineered it. And he's got, it's supposed to go to trial next year. There are depositions of FAA and NORAD officials who believe that they were fooled into participating in one way or another in the stand down. The ex-wife of one of the still living hijackers who says he was getting government checks when they were married and was told where to live and what groups to associate with. And, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Butler from the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, who was, the Pentagon unsuccessfully tried to court-martial him for revealing the fact that he was ordered to train Mohammed Atta in espionage at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey. So, but it's only gotten the publicity from the San Francisco Examiner article, very short article, and he was on Hannity and Colmes on Fox, and Sean Hannity just yelled at him and then hung up on him. So.
Even on in the alternative press, because we play a lot of that on Lover, and we don't hear anything about it.
Right.
But the alternative press has been bad, basically, on 9/11. It's very hard to even get the peace organizations to acknowledge the 9/11 issue. It's hard to know
why.
That's a very good question. I was shocked. I mean, when it was Kevin Donaher's idea to demand the congressional investigation of 9/11, and I had a bunch of different human rights peace organizations with me on that day. And then when we had all this evidence and all these questions, I thought the peace organizations would be interested, but they were a lot of them were afraid, and they didn't think the public should know about it or would want to know about it. Even if it was true, they didn't want to frighten people from participating in the anti-war activism. But what I've found out is I'm out in the streets in downtown Palo Alto every week tabling. I have a listening project, and I have all my 9/11 materials, and people are hungry for this information. That's why we went to Sacramento. That's why we've been at all the anti-war rallies. And, you know, ordinary people want to know the truth. They want to know what's going on. And a lot of them have become, like I became an activist after seeing JFK. When I realized the magnitude, I mean, of course, it's a life or death situation for the whole planet, for you know, democracy in this whole country. And people should become involved. It's So people are hungry.
For that T I M, that timing, T I M I E, T I M I E, timid, that timid of the L E of the left,
yes,
is one of the M A major B blocks,
yes,
of to see change.
Yes, yes. And we're afraid it's the co-option, the really big established left. It's co-opted. Look at the foundation money. Look at the influences, even the large groups. I mean, when we organized the showing of Guerrilla News Network's Aftermath at the Herbst Theater and at Gunn High School in Palo Alto, we couldn't get a nonprofit organization to be our 501c3 sponsor. It cost us an extra $850 to get the theaters. It was so hard to get any of them to become sponsors. Veterans for Peace and Not in Our Name decided to be sponsors, but it was so hard to get anyone. Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, they're the sponsors of my listening project every week, and they're the ones who sponsored the initial march on our senators. And I actually spoke on 9/11 at the Western Regional Conference, and the women were really interested in the issue, but it's taken a long time for them to come around, and I don't think they're ready to take it on as an organization. But when I spoke at the conference, I asked people, I said, how many of you think that JFK was killed by one crazy lone assassin? No one raised their hand. I said, how many of you think that the World Trade Center was brought down by 17 guys with box cutters? And nobody raised their hand. And then I said, and how many of you think it was a special operation to get public support for the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and the war on the Constitution, the Bill of Rights at home? And most of them raised their hand. So there's been a shift in consciousness.
How many think P A U Paul W E, what's his last name?
Wellstone
J,
yeah,
you just happened to crash.
All right. I think there's a lot of suspicion about Paul Wellstone's crash. A lot. But again, I don't think they're making it a political issue or talking about it. And I think it's a very deliberate strategy of trying to keep the left over here and the right over here and have them attack each other instead of looking at what's happening on top.
F R A fragmentation,
right.
Keeping people
right.
Fragmented.
But this is one thing that could unite 95% of the American people if they knew the truth, if they had the basic facts, just the facts.
Why do the L, why did the left K keep F A falling? F.A. falling two in to W.I.S.H. wishy-washy.
That's a good question. I mean, I'm furious at him.
The R, the right, don't have that problem.
That's true, whether it's the establishment neocon right or it's the the old-fashioned conservatives that love the Constitution and so on, they tend to be much bolder in what their positions are. in some ways. I mean, there's certainly a lot of bold people on the left, but it seems like the left has a problem with anything that involves criminality or deliberately planning. They like to blame
their political enemies as being,
yeah, it's all blundering, it's all, right. Yeah,
you know. They, B, E, believe, the, A, M, American, M,
myths.
The American myth.
Yeah, well, it's sad. You know, Noam Chomsky, I had some exchanges with Noam on this, and Noam still believes in the magic bullet that killed JFK, and he wrote me this not very nice letter that said, with the qualitative evidence we have on 9/11, we could prove the White House was blown up yesterday. And he completely dismisses all the evidence of complicity. He won't even look at it. Oh, and the left, in where I live, they just want me to shut up and say, you are an embarrassment to the left. From the big peace organization where I live. But I just go out in the street, I just try to go around them.
I always get that. Frank always gets that. That's kind of what I was thinking, that it seems like in the various kind of subcultures that we've been involved in, it seems like there's always that, the way we're talking about the left now.
Uh-huh.
There's always the edge of them that, like, kind of, like, I don't know, aspire to legitimacy or something. And
oh, yeah. Oh, somebody was telling me about, like, and I think it's true to some degree, that when there were some kidnappers, they took over a bank or something, they had a whole bunch of hostages, and the women hostages slept with the people who had them at gunpoint. And I think mentally it was to help themselves to not feel powerless in the situation, to think that they had some control over the situation, to think that they were somewhat safer because they were... Mm. So I think in some ways the left, the top left, are aspiring to be closer and are compromised.
There's also
deeply.
The funding compromises in the same way that a politician becomes compromised. If you want to talk about children suffering from DU in Iraq, you can't talk about was Wellstone assassinated.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you lose your money.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Some. L.
And there's just the prostitution.
E.
Some of them.
F. Some lefts would, will, not come on the show. Yeah, because S.E. sex. Well, because of Frank, because of the erotic nature of Frank's performance art. And even though this is like a whole different thing, they're here and they're coming to talk about what they do, they don't want to be associated with it. E. F. F. E. F. F. Oh.
What does that stand for, that organization?
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
I know those guys.
Well, we finally did have one of the attorneys here, but it was only because we decided to kick their butts. But initially, when Frank emailed them and said, I mean, here we are, Lover, who is exactly the kind of organization that they're supposed to exist to defend.
Right.
And so Frank says he would like to have one of their people on to talk about what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, she writes back and she says, I've looked at your site and I don't see what we possibly could have in common. And so he writes back and he lists all the things like that we could talk about. You know? Well, we are an internet says da 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 da. And she never writes back. That's the last we hear from her. And we were just like, we're ready to not deal with them. And then we actually got our butts kicked by Gerald Smith, who said, you know, you gotta call these people to task. You can't just like say they're fucked up and forget them.
Right.
Okay. So we go and we get everybody on their board of directors and they say, don't CC everybody, which we do. And we send it to everybody and we get a nasty email back, you know, this is why nobody wants to talk to you because you do stuff like this. But, and then we did get an email back and
from an attorney who profusely apologized, said, I'm sorry everything got all messed up like that, and yes, I'd love to be on your show, and da 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 da. And she, I think she did kind of admit that, you know, there are prudes among them and stuff like that, and that, you know, that the people were afraid to come on the show.
But see, that's part of the problem, too, is that people say is that is a very useful tool for elites wanting to control people to come along and say, well, to instill this in us that if you disagree with one thing, that you can't deal with people on other things. And that's what, you know, that's one of the ways they manipulate the what they call the Hegelian dialectic, where the two groups of people you want to control, you keep them apart based on some ideological premise. And you achieve what you want by them fighting with each other.
Yes. They. You. S. Use. That. On. The. B. L. Black. Panthers.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you look at COINTELPRO, I mean, we have this new apparatus which is going to be infinitely worse than COINTELPRO if they do get themselves organized and hire as many people as they'd like to hire with Homeland Security, etc.
What is LOCA local? C. C. U. R. R.
Currency.
Oh, local currency.
I. M. A. G. Great. I. N. Interview.
He's always the first to tell us.
Oh. Well, local currency is a wonderful tool to raise consciousness about what is money, how is it created, and what is it used for. The deception dollars, to some degree, have become a community currency, and they're exchanged amongst 9/11 activists. I trade the deception dollars for books and for videos. And it's just a sort of a cooperative barter system. But the regular dollars that we have are created by bankers out of thin air, sometimes not even physically real, but are just simply a electronic, okay, you want to buy a house, you need $500,000, you owe us $500,000, we just have the records of it. But they're not backed by gold or anything real other than the government's ability to tax its citizens. And if you look at the history of money, the system that we have now began with the fractional reserve system started with the goldsmiths discovered that they could take people's gold and store it and give them a receipt saying this is worth a pound of gold. And the receipts were more useful than lugging around, you know, a pound of gold, and that people didn't come back to get their gold. It was just so much more convenient to have the paper. And you didn't need gold for every little piece of paper you could create it. You could have a pound of gold and write out 10 pounds worth of receipt and charge interest on the receipt. And this used to be forbidden by law. There was a taboo against it. It was called usury. But over the years, it changed, partially because the Catholic Church became the largest landowner in Europe, and they changed the mores of the time, and it happened rather gradually. It took, you know, hundreds of years. But at this point in time, most people have no idea who creates money and how our debt-based system, the bankers, like magicians, created out of thin air. They lend it out at interest, and it's physically impossible to pay back all the money that is out and loans. It just hasn't been existed. I mean, mathematically, it's impossible. You need three or four planets to pay back all that money. The whole system is a disaster waiting to happen. And in the process, you have 20% of the world's population who benefits from the unearned interest of the debt-based system. You have 80% who are suffering terribly and having to pay for it. And if you looked at just everyday objects and what people do normally, half the cost of all the goods and services we get are the hidden price of money. That's how much it is. It's like, you know, 50% of all the stuff that you eat, all the money that you earn, it goes to paying that hidden money cost. And it's a continuous transference of wealth. So the good thing about community currencies and local currencies is basically you recognize that money is agreement and that it doesn't have, the old system has sort of been imposed upon us by military force. But you can create a community currency based on respect, agreement amongst people to increase relationships and bonds between people and to serve a community and to meet the community needs. And you can create it in a democratic way. So one of the people who's pioneered local currency in this country is Paul Glover in Ithaca. He created the Ithaca Hours. But there's actually many different varieties of local currencies and many different ways that they're created. There's no single cookie cutter method of creating a community currency that works for every single community. One community currency is if you have a babysitting co-op and you just write down and you keep track of how many hours you babysit for somebody else's child, how many hours they owe you. I mean, that is a currency too. It's an agreement. It's recognizing.
B.
Exchange.
A. R. T. Barter.
Yeah, and community currency promotes barter. It facilitates if you have a more complex barter, if, you know, you have three or four people. Somebody needs haircuts, somebody needs dentistry, somebody needs a massage, and this way everyone can just exchange and recognize that this is worth a service that they can trade amongst other people in the communities. And what's happened too is in 1971 or 73, Nixon removed the dollar completely from any tangible assets. It became a complete floating currency. And before then, it had some attachment to real stuff. And if you looked at the foreign exchange transactions, 2% of them were speculative and 98% of them had to do with the exchange of real goods and services. And since 1973, it's gambling. The foreign exchange transactions, there's trillions of dollars whirling around the planet, creating all sorts of havoc and devastation. And 98% of the exchanges are speculative, and only 2-3% had to do with real goods and services. And as this curve is going up like this, what's happening is the failure of all these economies in so many countries. People are reinventing money, and there's new forms of community currencies that are emerging all over the world. In the United States, it's not as popular as other parts because people aren't as desperate. But when the monetary system collapses, then people do reinvent money. And so there's a greater and greater interest in community currencies. In Argentina, with the collapse of the banking system, they have it's like a barter network, a different form of community currency, and there's hundreds and thousands of people in Argentina because that's where community currencies thrive, where the existing systems fail and people need to exchange their goods and services. They have to reinvent money.
One. B. L. O. C. Block. Two. C. H. A. Change is the would be A. C. T. I, activists, thinking, they need a L O a lot of money and B R E A reaching like millions of people for it to be worthwhile. We've run into that when people who Frank says, well, you could start a lover yourself. We could do something like that. And they're not interested in finding out how to do it in an affordable way, which is the way we did it and do it. They think that they have to do it so that they're capable of reaching thousands and thousands and thousands of people right away. And they have to have proof that they have the audience out there. So they can't do it until they have enough money to do that. And, that sort of thing.
I think people can be effective activists. I was explaining to Cosmos on the way over here, when I realized how the monetary system worked, I sort of made an inner vow that I'd give every penny I had to change the monetary system. And I actually, I came from a wealthy Republican family and I had a lot of money actually. And I gave away all my money to just seed the idea of local currencies and transforming the global economy. And I ran out of money in 1997. And since then, I've been an activist, but living on my grocery money, because I have three kids and taking care of the kids all the time. And you can do so much with just a little bit of bit of money. And then if you work and if you have any imagination, like the deception dollars, I got in touch with the artist. I saw he actually contacted me because we did a lot of 9/11 events, marches and rallies, and he contacted me and he showed me his beautiful artwork. He does these great satirical movie posters. He has a fantastic image of Hitler with the Reichstag fire and Bush with the World Trade Center towers. You've seen his work.
I've seen it, yeah.
And so I was asking him, can I use your images on my flyers? Because I'm always tabling and passing things out of the marches. And you need the great art and the images, or people won't read the text. Mm-hmm. They won't get the message. Mm-hmm. So, and he said, well, my mom thinks I should get a real job and shouldn't waste my time on this political art. And I said, no, do the political art. We need it. And I didn't have much money, but I sent him some money so that I could use his images on my flyers. And he had done the front of the deception dollar. I said, if you could just do the back, then we could make a lot of them and pass them out at the anti-war demonstrations. So he did the back, and from all my tabling, I actually, for an activist, usually you do give away a lot of money, but when we started selling the 9/11 magazines and the books, I started actually making a little bit of money, so I put all the money into making the first deception dollars, and it cost $600, and we made 10,000 of them, and we gave them away so fast. People loved them. Within a couple of weeks, we ran out of them. And then we contacted the publisher of The War on Freedom, which is the best book on 9/11, and he helped us to raise enough money to make 100,000 for the next big anti-war march. But we ran out of the deception dollars before the march. And then we ended up selling so many books and tapes on 9/11 at the rallies that I was able to raise enough money to make 500,000 deception dollars. And then we ran out of them in less than a month. So we made $1 million deception dollars. And then in less than a month, we raised like $8,000, which was a huge amount of money for activists. So that's when we We decided we'll have a big event. We'll break this issue in the mainstream press. And we got the Herbst Theater and Gunn High School. And we showed Guerrilla News Network's aftermath. We had Mike Rupert come. We had Barry Zwicker, who did the first televised questioning the official story. He flew down from Canada. The artists came. We had Peter Dale Scott, Reva Entine, and Richard Heinberg for Palo Alto, because he wrote the book, The Party's Over, War, Oil, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. And he is also cognizant on the 9/11. And we had it on Earth Day. And to just tie the whole thing together, we had him. But we wouldn't have been able to done it if we hadn't raised all the money with our deception dollars. And that's just, getting information for doing some great art, being creative, and people being hungry for the information. And then you just keep going. All the money that I've made from tabling as an activist, it's all gone back into just producing the materials. It's not like we're trying to get rich or anything, but we just want to keep growing the issue.
Like us. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
just
exactly
get the information out.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever any money comes in, it goes right back into doing this stuff.
Doing the work. Yeah. And that's what one of our next big projects, I think we'll try to have a big conference again and try to break the issue in the mainstream press, and also just bring together the researchers and the activists who've been doing this work to help put the pieces together. And another thing that we'd like to do is make a better film, a more comprehensive film, because there's a lot of films on 9/11 out, but we need better tools to put all the pieces together in a way that can reach more people.
I B E T I bet the D O the dollar will be E become A S Y a symbol of this P E this period of time.
The deception dollar?
Yes, that's what he means.
Yeah,
yes.
They are in the fancy art museum in San Francisco now, the one overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge. And the artist and I went to see the curator, and one of the curator's daughters took down all of her teeny bop posters and just has a deception dollar on her wall. Really impressed us. And we're really happy. People have started collecting them. In fact, if you try to get a first edition of the deception dollar, I only have one crumpled one left, but there's people paying like
$2
each for the first editions. They are becoming collector's items.
I gave some to some people from the Uhuru Party in Oakland, and they and a bunch of them took them to St. Petersburg, Florida, and were giving them out at a city council meeting, and it ended up they ended up being discussed for, I don't know, an hour or so on the morning program, just discussing them and discussing the websites and discussing the issues on those websites.
And we've made four giant deception dollar banners. We have one in Canada, one in New York, one in Washington, D.C., and one here. And the media can't resist the image, even if... But I must say, it's very hard to break the information in the mainstream press. And when Bush was here recently, we had our big banner, and I tried to give more deception dollars to the NBC. And they're like, oh, the whole office is full of them. And I got mad. I said, well, why don't you do the issues? Why don't you talk about the military stand down and the links between the terrorists and the U.S. government? And they were quiet. I mean, I've actually, when we were protesting General Myers in San Francisco, and I had Nafisa's book, The War on Freedom, I gave press packets to channel 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, and GNN was there too. And I had all the information, and none of the major stations would air it. It was just GNN who made the film and actually did something with the information. So I think they're still getting the signal from on high. And then even with the Herbst Theater, when we did that event, we had a full house at the Herbst, you know, 1,000 people. We had a standing ovation. We had to turn 300 people away because the theater was full. Mm-hmm. And the mainstream press all knew about it. They all had invitations, and there wasn't one word that appeared. The only thing they did on 9/11 was a couple weeks later, the kookiest 9/11 activist, the one who thinks Willie Brown did it, they did an article on him, but they wouldn't look at all the hard stuff, all the real information.
That
and they wouldn't even talk about, you know, the mission.
S-T-A. Standard.
Yeah.
T. A. Tactic.
Yes. And I love what Schopenhauer said about truth, where first it is ridiculed, then it is bitterly fought, and then it is accepted as common wisdom. And I'm sure we'll reach that point, but I just hope it's sooner rather than later, so we can contain the damage that's being done now. I thought we could stop the Iraq war if we could expose this in time. And that's why I felt so bitterly betrayed by the peace movement, because they didn't dare talk about it.
We did S A save a lot of lives. We did save a lot of lives.
The peace movement by making this much noise. Well, that's good.
Yes.
I wish we could have stopped it though.
The Iraq war was delayed, and when you put all the emphasis on, if there weren't those protests of the wars, there would have been much less emphasis on. There would have been much more civilian casualties.
Yes.
But we were presented with a false choice by the established left, who said, let the inspections work. They tried to say we could have national fascism dominated by the U.S. or transnational fascism, where the resources of Iraq will be divided amongst the imperial powers. And I don't think that's a good choice between this fascism or that fascism. What we need to do is abolish fascism and expose it.
And get are rid of the C.
Corporations. Yes.
They that P.
Profit from
war.
Yes. We added Bechtel and Carlyle to the bills too.
Get rid of W. E. A. L. Wealthy. Wealth. Get rid of wealth.
The extreme concentration of wealth. It's like manure. If you spread it around, it helps everything grow. If you pile it up, it does no one any good.
I and the F O focus on getting W E wealthy. Yes. Get rid of the focus on getting wealthy.
Yes.
R A rather than M A making A L living.
Yeah. And I think there's the difference between money and real wealth. And I think if we recognize that our real wealth is healthy relationships between people, between people and the earth, that's where you're rich, when you have those healthy relationships and joy and happiness in your life. It's not when you have tons of this, of money or...
That is...
material stuff.
S-E... are S-E-R-U-C.
Surrogate.
I. T. Y. S-E-R. No.
Security?
Security.
Security,
yes. That is security.
Right. And that, I think that's what happens too, is these, the people who amass wealth, it's because they're frightened, because they don't have healthy relationships and they don't depend on society to take care of them. If they get sick or old, who's going to take care of them? So they use money as sort of a security blanket. And it's a very false security. Especially if you've ever been really sick or threatened with a life threatening illness, you realize that money is...
Or their dad shot him in the butt with a BB gun, like W.
What was that?
Well, Jeff, in a speech, it came out in a couple of newspapers in Florida a few months ago, where Jeb Bush just happened to mention in passing in a speech that when he was a kid, him and his brothers would be made to strip down to their underwear and they'd be shot in the butt with BB guns by their father.
You didn't know that.
Thank you.
But it, I, you
and
have, yeah.
I get, and I get shit.
But yeah, I must say, you hear this story, and you have to feel sorry for those guys. I mean, their dad obviously abused them, and that's why they're so dysfunctional, because they just...
Wow.
They just have been messed up since they were little, and they're under daddy's control.
That, E, explains a lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Have you interviewed Derek Jensen?
Mm-mm.
Do you know about him? Mm-mm. He wrote A Language Older Than Words. He's you should have him on as a guest. He's great. We were actually trying to do a 9/11 film with him, and he came from a wealthy family, and when he was young, his father raped him. And unfortunately, I think if you see the situation in the United States today, you can see parallels between the dysfunctional family and the country as a whole, especially with a father raping a child. And you see the president screwing the country. And in a dysfunctional family, the first rule is you don't talk about it. The second rule is you don't talk that you talk about it. That you don't talk about it. And the third rule is you don't talk that you don't talk that you don't talk about it. And it's the same thing here now when they're doing these horrific things. The media doesn't talk about it, and it's taboo for people to question it, and it's even taboo to question that they're not questioning it.
Right. The M O, the most, the M O D E, the model, M O D, modern, F A L. Don't, W, O, R, work.
Was modern it, family doesn't work.
The modern family doesn't work. It's like not a functional
it's
unit.
It's dysfunctional.
Yes. It is a T, O, O, tool for... F R A G fragmenting.
Oh,
I and I S isolating.
Well, I'm sure that they try to fragment actually the family unit itself and the individuals in society.
T R I tribal or E X
extended family.
Extended.
Yeah, those are healthier. Yes. Generally.
Yes. Well, also it seems like the modern, especially in America, you see a huge difference between the average American family of people who've been Americans for generations and immigrant families, where there's more, there's this huge emphasis on, in maybe the same emphasis on the sort of things like, you know, the parents wanting to, the children to be little replicants of them and control them and everything. But the difference is you don't have the same kind of thing. Like, when you go down to these, you go down, walk into a little corner liquor store that's owned by a bunch of people who are immigrants from another country. They all work there. They all help each other out. It doesn't, you know, it's very different. Very different.
M O more M O D E L modeled of four K I D role models for kids. There are role models for the kids within that immigrant family.
Yeah, and that's so, well, it seems. Yeah, it seems.
And even for the G R O W, grown-ups, role models for the grown-ups. Are you talking about, like, that it's like an extended family? What he's talking about, the immigrant family in the corner store. There are more role models for the kids because it's not just the mother and father, but it's the aunt and uncle or the grandmother or grandfather. That's takes the emphasis off of the mother and the father. What? I? We? Oh, the way we raised? We raised two kids and there were at least five parents at all times and sometimes more. We were like a group relationship and there were two kids. And the kids, even though they knew who their biological parents were not encouraged to emphasize that. And so they had to deal with all of us as their parents. And really seemed like a healthy way to raise kids because there weren't any of those things, that those lock-ins with like the mother and the kid or the father and the kid. It was like we all lived together. They just happened to be younger than the rest of us. And we all had to have responsibility in the relationship, and we held them to that same standard. And we actually had Koala, he's the one kid, Koala Bear Moore, on the show. He's like an activist now, and he was talking about the experience of growing up in that kind of a environment, and how he didn't really realize for a lot of his life that was unusual.
Well, of course, kids always think their life is normal, and that everybody has the sort of growing up, the experience that they have. But I have three kids, and I know for me, the real profound change in my marriage and the family situation was when I took a workshop with Bill Moyer, who wrote the book Doing Democracy, and he had been working, the workshop was called Building Equality in Relationships, and I thought, yeah, that's what I want, more equality. but Bill had been working with men who had been violent towards their wives, and he discovered that 4% is physical, and then 30 or 40% is verbal, and the rest is psychological, and that the guys would attack their wives because they felt that the wife's words or behavior was threatening their view of themselves or their worldview, and that they were under attack, and so it was in defense of themselves that they would be forcing the wife to play the supportive role for their image of themselves or their worldview, and that unconsciously that's sort of the way society functions, and the way we respond to other people too when they challenge our perception of ourselves or our worldview. And he taught us to just sort of take a deep breath, ground yourself, and recognize it as a moment of fatal peril, and realize that your happiness and well-being doesn't depend on somebody else's view of you. It's on your perception of yourself. And just take this challenge to your perception as important information to see how this person sees themselves and the world. And then you can get into dialogue and have a healthy relationship instead of always fighting to defend your belief in your, you know, your worldview or yourself. And that transformed my relationship with my husband because he doesn't share my radical political views. And then we also changed our relationship with the kids too. So the kids also, we don't force our worldview on the kids and we have a cooperative relationship rather than the you do it because I tell you to do it kind of relationship. And it's good now because one reason Abel and I were able to go to Sacramento for the weekend is my husband and the kids were, yeah, go mom. And they supported me and they understood what I was doing. And also they were appreciative because I took them river rafting on the American River a couple weeks ago. And it was like, okay, you can do your table in Sacramento if you take us river rafting. Sure. But we just try to work cooperatively. So everybody gets to do what they want to do and everybody's happy. Yeah. So we do, and even though, you know, it works, but I have a great husband too. I think it helps. If you do have my husband, he's also a pack leader for the Cub Scouts and I met him. He was rescuing wildlife, working for wildlife rescue, and he's got like this huge heart. He's just the most loving, gentle, patient, wonderful person who hates politics and doesn't want to have anything to do with politics. But he's, you know, I can go off and do my activism for 10 days and leave him with three kids, even if the kids are in diapers, and he can handle it. He's great. And so So I don't think the family is totally dead in America. I mean, I think I'm really lucky, but we have a healthy sort of traditional family where I live. And it gives me the strength to do the kind of activism that I do.
Not that traditional. Your situation isn't that traditional.
Well, yeah, but it's not that far afield.
Well, on the surface it appears that you have the two adults and then you have the children and the adults are married and it's just like on the surface it appears traditional.
Right. And I make the apple pies I take to the teachers and I help them in schools. And I have my big Real Terrorist Bush Cheney Rumsfeld banners in downtown Palo Alto every week, but that's okay.
K. Oh. Koala. S. Said. He. T. H. He thought. All. Kids. Now the thing about being responsible. At a certain point, Frank would have meetings with people that were studying with him out in our garage studio. And so the kids grew up knowing that Frank would go out to the studio with people. I think Koala was like 7 or 8 or something like that when he, R, I, ripped off some money from us in the house and then lied about it and let another kid take the blame for it, a black kid take the blame for it. And when we got hip to the fact that he had done that, it's time for you to start having meetings with Frank in the studio. And so this little kid, you know, he had to come home on Wednesdays right from school to go out for his meeting with Frank. And he'd have a weekly meeting, you know, up through into high school where Frank would just talk to him about things like that and just about being responsible and how you create your own reality based on how you deal with things in your life and other people and it all comes back to you and just all the, like, basic nuts and bolts. So we do this interview with him a year or so ago. He's now, like, 27 or something like that. And he said, you know, I thought like that. Everybody thought that. He said, because I think when you told me that when I was 7, I got it. Do you think I got it? I thought I got it. He said, and now I look and I think, wow, I don't think Bush ever was taught that. You know? Like, you look and it seems like most people don't get that. And K. E. V. Kevin Danaher. Kevin Danaher. T. R. Try. 2. P. U. Pull. Pull a fast one. This was when we were trying to line him up to be on this show, and it took a long time, like months. And one time he didn't come, he didn't wake up, he had been up all night and flew in from New York or something like that. There's always like something. And we finally get a date, and he's really going to be there, and we confirm. And we get a call from him like at 7 o'clock that night. Is this like a 45-minute, an hour show? We said, well, no, it's a 2-hour show. You knew that.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you're kidding. He said, my wife, you know, he goes on about his wife. Oh, if only she would be home. You know, she's never home, and now I have the kids, and, you know, and I'm responsible for my daughter, and so I can't.
Did he bring her?
Well, Frank said, bring her. Oh, she doesn't want to come. You know? He said, well, how's about if we just, like, do it for 45 minutes, you know? Frank said, oh, no, I'd rather wait and set up another date. Because the whole pressure was, you know, of course we're finally here. You're going to just let me come for 45 minutes. But no, I think we'll just set up another date and go for the 2 hours. So he sets up another date, and he did, you know, he came for the 2 hours. Well, actually, it was more like almost 3 hours. He said he could not. They said, you want a couple talking heads on here for 2 hours? What, really? You don't, are we really going to have something to talk about for 2 hours? And Frank said, it will be fine. You know, I do this all the time. It'll be fine. And so about 2 hours and 15 minutes into it, Frank starts kind of laying into him about that. He goes, well, look what time it is. It's, you know, he'd been talking pretty much nonstop.
I know, Kevin.
About that. A. P. U. He's a punk. That's what Frank called him right at the beginning. How'd a punk like you get involved in all this political stuff? Yeah, it's, that's been 2 hours. Yeah. So is this, are we wrapping? So you should give your names and anything you want to say, websites, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I'm Carol Brouillet, and I've been trying to expose the complicity of Bush administration and the CIA in 9/11. And my website is very long and complicated, so I usually just try to tell people if they go to the deceptiondollar.com website, they can find some terrific 9/11 websites, which give them lots of information. And Abel, you want to?
My name's Abel Ashes, and I'm just trying to expose problem, reaction, solution, and the strategy of tension, and it goes on through the ages, over and over again. Governments use terror against their own people to get them to submit to tyranny. And let's see, I'm going to recommend some websites. I say go to madcowprod.com and look at the stuff on the flight schools. And for info on the end of the oil age, go to dieoff.org and oilpeak.com and energycrisis.org. And for info on the U.S. police state, go to infowars.com.
You are... E, remind me of A F R a friend of my K of my M O mother who G A gave me a lot of books. I remember you write about that. Frank had a friend of his mother. They would, her and Frank's mom would get together and talk about politics and psychology and all that stuff, and she would give Frank books to read. That was D A N dangerous B E because we were in on the Army or the Air Force military base in Germany.
Oh, really? Wow.
It got you thinking.
Yeah. Well, if you want any more books and tapes, I do have, you know, the 9/11 info central practically we have in the car. We've got an extraordinary collection of 9/11 materials. I don't know what all you have, but
if you want to, they're all packed.
The car's full, but
we P like will we will P play whatever. You give us, we'll play on Lover.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'll see which ones that I have that you don't have.
Okay.
And then you can play them.
Yes. Yay. This will be on BTV will also play this. Frank has a weekly show on Berkeley's Public Access channel.
Excellent.
It'll be on there too. And our
Radio
for All, the audio of it will go onto there. That happens pretty much right away.
Yeah.
And then we archive the audio on our website too, so this will stay up on there. Your player's going to stop. Hit play again. Who is next week? Ugh. Let's see. Oh, Simon Harris, the Organic Consumers National Campaign. Can't see without my glasses. Director, I think. Yes. A. About genetically modified foods.
Oh, good.
Yeah, he actually lives right down the street. And
I bet he's in Sacramento right now.
Yeah, that's right. And he's been helping us with work that we've been trying, our local natural grocery store. We've been really trying to kick their butts to take a stand on it. And, slowly but surely they're responding to the pressure. But, you know, it's like it's the natural grocery store. They're worried about places like Trader Joe losing their business to places like that because they sell organic foods cheaper. And yet they're afraid to take a stand. The store has slowly been adding more genetically modified foods, and they have Heinz ketchup now, organic Heinz ketchup, and sugars, and just all the stuff that a natural grocery store is not supposed to have, they're having. And so we're trying to kick their butts into realizing that their only hope is to really stand for something, and that will be their business move. That will give them a niche that will make them stay in business.
Yeah,
but they're really kicking and screaming.
But part of it is, though, organic and natural. Natural has always been nothing defined legally, so natural can include anything, whereas organic, they actually tried to create some standards. And then those the corporations tried to change the definition, and they fought it off, I think, successfully.
Right now,
but we'll see how long it lasts. That's one of the sad things, the whole co-option of language.
Yeah.
The Orwellian use of language.
Yes.
So black means white, and white means black.
Yeah. Okay, we'll try again, huh? Yes. I and C O C O M I coming up the H O hot J, the hot jam. Okay, so Susie Block is at 11, and then following Susie Block is Playing with Passion, and tonight we will be replaying the hot jam that we did in Huntington Beach a couple of weeks ago. So be there or be square. Okay, your player's going to stop. Hit play again.